Okay, good morning. Fire 241, and it is September 17th. And, oh, was that a question? Were you asking me a question when I started talking? No? Okay. All right, so your tasks for review are, I give them back to the lab instructor. And so the morning class Tuesday saw their exams. But the afternoon class, I brought the exams in, and the instructor said that you all took a vote or something and you didn't want to take a look at them. I don't understand what happened. Okay. But anyway, I urge you to come and take a look at the tests, and I can give them back to your instructor so that you individually can look them over in lab, and the answer key is there. Or if you want to come to my office hours and look them over, that's fine too. So if you... I wouldn't wait until next week if you want to come to my office hours, and I'd be happy to show you that. But remember, if we give a Scantron back to you and you can do whatever you want with it, we can't ever regrade it again. So if you're concerned you made some mistakes, like smudges on the Scantron or something, then go over it right there and then with your instructor, whether it's me or your lab instructor, and then we can correct it and then give you credit for those questions. All right? But once it loses, you know, our control, then... you know, we can't really regrade it. So maybe that was the issue somebody was concerned about. Yeah. My office hours today after this class, I think until about 3:30. So Tuesday, Thursday until 3:30. And then Monday I have some office hours pretty late in the afternoon. But they're on the syllabus too. I can hardly remember my office hours. And they're posted on my door. Yeah. Well, if you go over it person just one-on-one with your lab instructor, you can. All right, but like for instance, if I give you the Scantron and you hold it for a half hour or something and then point it out to me that there's a mistake on your Scantron like a half hour later or an hour later, then yeah, of course I can't regrade it. Okay, so that's just the way it is. So you should have a lot of confidence, right, in filling out those Scantrons. I was a little surprised that you guys didn't want to see your tests on Tuesday. Because I don't think it's a really high-level skill to fill out a Scantron. You know, basically, you guys should have confidence that you fill out a Scantron properly. I mean, what do you think is more difficult, taking care of a neonate in an oxygen tent or filling out a Scantron? Come on, you guys, fill out the answer you want on the Scantron, make sure there's no stray marks on it, and you're ready to go. But, you know, if you want to check it out individually, I'm really happy to do that with you guys. And then, of course, I can answer questions, too, if you have a question about a particular question on the test. Okay. And the other thing is, too, if you ever take a board exam, you'll never see your Scantrons, right? So you might get gypped out of all kinds of points on a board exam if you don't know how to fill out a Scantron. So... anyway, that's just a little additional practice in this class. And I'm sure this is not the first class where you filled out Scantrons for grades. All right, so anyway. I do have a comment about the schedule. I see that on exam number 2, which is scheduled for October 1st, according to the schedule, I've included chapter 9. Okay, so let me just make sure I got the right schedule here. Syllabus 241. Fall 2009. This is it. Well, I've got chapter 9 in there, and there should not be chapter 9 in exam 2. So it's just going to be chapters 4, 5, and 7. And you've already been tested on chapter 6. All right, so I don't know if we're going to have the test on October 1st, but maybe we can still sneak it in by that date. But whenever we have the test, it's going to be over chapters 4, 5, and 7. Okay, any questions about that? 4, 5, and 7? Okay. And so 9, I'm going to have to look and see what 9 is. 9 is autonomic nervous system. Yeah, that's one we can't skip. So that will be on the next test after that.
So okay. 9, 10, 11.
I have no idea. You have to keep coming to class, and I'll update you. Okay. All right, so the next test I know for sure. Okay, so... that's what you should be doing over the weekend. All right, so we were talking about metabolism. We're just starting metabolism, some biochemistry, some real biochemistry last time. And what is a good definition? What's a good working definition of metabolism? It is just the, it's just the sum, it's the addition of all the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body. That's metabolism. And you measured some features of metabolism in lab this week, like the production of oxygen, the consumption of oxygen and the production of CO2. These are ways that we can measure a certain kind of respiration in animals. And I think, what's the animal model that you're using? Are we using frogs or rabbits or
mice?
Mice. That's a good one. Okay, yeah, because they don't bite real hard. That's really nice. Okay, and remember, there's two kinds of metabolism. Furthermore, we can break metabolism down into reactions that build molecules up. What do we call that?
Anabolic.
Yeah, those are anabolic reactions as opposed to reactions that break things down. And those are catabolic, right? And then you should know which ones are typically exergonic and which ones are typically endergonic. Which ones release energy? The catabolic reactions. Yeah, that should be on the tip of your tongue somehow, and maybe somehow really get familiar with it, not just memorize it. Okay? Okay. All right, so let's proceed on to glycolysis. So one of the major energy sources for making ATP in your body is glycolysis. And the entry molecule that allows glycolysis to operate is glucose. Right? So glucose is the energy molecule. That's the fuel molecule that enters glycolysis. And what glycolysis does is that it breaks glucose down into two fragments. So how many carbons does glucose have? It has six carbons. And if you snip it in half, what are the two resulting molecules? How many carbons do the two resulting molecules have?
Three.
They've got three, right? So pyruvic acid, or pyruvate, that's the same term, have three carbon atoms each. This pathway, this is just a little synopsis of glycolysis that we'll look at a little bit more detail, does not require oxygen. All right, so you should realize that there's an organelle in your cells that requires oxygen in order to make ATP. Does anybody know what organelle that is? Mitochondria need oxygen, right? So glycolysis really doesn't have anything to do with mitochondria because it doesn't require oxygen. It is a bunch of metabolic pathways, or it is a metabolic pathway, which is a bunch of chemical reactions that happens in the cytosol. It does not require organelle. All right. The overall chemical equation for glycolysis is the following. Well, it needs glucose. And it needs a couple coenzymes called NAD. It needs two NAD. And remember, you should actually probably put NAD plus right here. NAD is really an ion. It has a overall positive charge, which means that it can what? It readily accepts electrons because it is a cation. All right. So when NAD, when you see NAD, that's really the oxidized form of NAD. And maybe you should just say NAD plus so that you become familiar with it. Okay, glycolysis can also take some adenosine diphosphate and some inorganic phosphate in the cytosol and put them together, right? And when you do, what do you make? You make ATP out of it. So let's write this equation like this. Let's see if this will help me with my lecture. If we have ADP, okay, ADP plus inorganic phosphate going to ATP, what kind of reaction is that? Exergonic or endergonic?
Endergonic.
Okay, that's an endergonic reaction. All right, so we got to put energy someplace. Where do we put energy? The left-hand side or right-hand side? Left-hand side, yeah. So it's going to require some energy in order to make that ATP because it's an endergonic reaction. All right, so where does your body get that energy from? The splitting of glucose in half to produce these two pyruvic acids, right? As a matter of fact, there's even more than enough energy for that to happen. And that extra energy is used for an oxidation reduction reaction where NAD plus is converted into NADH. So NADH, remember, these are, what is NAD, a coenzyme or a cofactor? It's a coenzyme. It's a big biological molecule. And a coenzyme is going to carry some kind of chemical from one chemical reaction to another, or from one location in the cell to another location in the cell. so that another chemical reaction can take place. What is the thing that NADH is carrying around with it? What do I really want you to focus on? Which is a little bit different than your book, but it's equivalent view, actually. It is electrons. And as a matter of fact, if you were to say high-energy electrons, that would even be better, because really what NADH is carrying around is energy in the form of those high-energy electrons. Okay. All right, so this is the overall balanced equation. All right, so glycolysis is exergonic, right? That has to mean that it produces enough energy to make ATP. Right? ATP just doesn't form all by itself. It gets the energy from glycolysis because it is exergonic. And glycolysis produces 2 ATP for every 1 glucose molecule that enters that metabolic pathway. All right, but to get glycolysis started, glucose has to be activated by 2 ATPs. We call that phosphorylation. What kind of enzyme phosphorylates something? It's a kinase, right? Yeah, there's a kinase there. All right, and an additional feature of glucose when it is phosphorylated, right, is that now it becomes trapped inside the cell. And so remember what that phosphate looks like? All right, a phosphate is going to be a highly charged particle because of these anions, because of these oxygens that have a negative charge. And what can you tell me about ions in terms of diffusing through the plasma membrane? Do they readily diffuse through a plasma membrane or not?
No.
Not. That's right, because remember the phospholipid bilayer, the inside, the inner layer of the plasma membrane is hydrophobic, so this kind of molecule just can never get through it, and this kind of anchors then the glucose inside the cell. So most cells, once they get glucose inside of them, they never want to give it up because glucose is energy, keeps that cell alive, right? Don't want to give it up. Yeah.
I have a question regarding the glycolysis.
Yeah.
Therefore, would it be one ATP per each pyruvic acid?
For each pyruvic acid, that's a really good way of looking at it. And because you got 2, there's a net reaction of 2 ATPs that are going to be produced. We're going to look in a little bit of detail, but I'm not going to have you memorize the steps. But I don't know, we could take a vote on it and see if you guys want to memorize the steps of glycolysis or not. Okay. But I've got a pretty good slide that shows that. So your question is right on. And you're going to go, oh yeah, that's what I mean. So I'll show you in just a second. All right, so here we have a diagram of glycolysis in a diagrammatic way. We understand, okay, that if we can plot out different intermediates in terms of their free energy, and remember, free energy is the amount of energy that can actually do work inside of a cell, glucose has a fair amount of free energy associated with it, right, compared to what? Pyruvic acid. So as glucose is converted into pyruvic acid, right, is there more free energy or less free energy in pyruvic acid? There's less, so this reaction proceeds pretty normally. And therefore, we say as glucose goes to pyruvic acid, since pyruvic acid has less free energy, it's what? An exergonic reaction. And it's exergonic by the amount of this change in free energy. All right, but you also notice that when glucose gets inside the cell, before it can move all the way down to pyruvic acid, the cell has to expend some energy to get it going. So for every glucose, how many ATPs does the cell lose to get glycolysis going? You see it right here. 1 and 2. All right, so glucose gets phosphorylated twice. All right, and once it does, then glycolysis can proceed all the way down to pyruvic acid. And when it does that, there are some other steps. For instance, one of the very last steps, 2 ATP can be converted into 2 ATP. One of the next to last steps, 2 more ATP can be converted into ATP. All right, so it looks like glycolysis is actually producing, what, 4 ATP for every glucose. But in order to get it started, what did you have to spend? 2. So when we looked at this equation right here, we saw that the net overall production of ATP is 2, right? It's 4 minus 2 to figure out how much ATP is produced. All right, so this energy, this change in free energy, glucose going to pyruvic acid, is now trapped in these ATP molecules, but also an additional molecule, which even has some more energy, and that is NADH. Because in the process of glycolysis, NAD plus is converted into NADH. As a matter of fact, two of them. All right, so what can you tell me about NAD plus? Is it oxidized or reduced? Okay, NAD plus is an oxidized form of NAD, and NADH is the reduced form, because there are some electrons that have been added to NAD plus to make NADH right here. All right, so I'm just going to say that a couple times, many times probably, just so that you get a feel for that oxidation-reduction reaction. Okay. All right, so don't forget, ADP going to ATP is endergonic, a reaction that typically won't happen. It has to get energy from someplace else. So on this slide right here, where does your cell get energy to make ATP? By glycolysis, or the splitting of glucose into two pyruvic acid molecules. That's highly exergonic. All right, so in terms of those gears that I showed you before, right, the little gear on the right-hand side is right here. It's turning in this direction, right, because that's an endergonic reaction. But what's the other bigger gear that's turning, that's providing the energy for the synthesis of ATP? Is glycolysis, right? Glucose being converted into two pyruvic acids. All right, so this is the whole, pretty much the whole glycolysis scheme. It doesn't show you the enzymes necessary for these interconversions. And so, what do you say? Should this be an exam figure, do you think? Maybe not so critical that it is. All right, but you should at least know the inputs and the outputs of glycolysis, where it takes place, and some other interesting features that we're going to look at. All right, so here's glucose. And again, you got to know how many carbons. It's got six carbons, and the first two steps are going to convert glucose into glucose 6-phosphate. All right, so that means that one phosphate is added to glucose, and it's on the sixth carbon, the number six. All right, so you can probably tell me what the name of that enzyme is. That is what? It's a kinase. All right, and then here is glucose 6-phosphate gets rearranged into fructose. Fructose is a six-carbon sugar, but a little bit different arrangement. And again, fructose is phosphorylated, so now you've got two phosphates on that sugar molecule, and it can't leave the cell, and that's what the cell really likes. It doesn't want to lose that energy once it takes it in. And then it gets split. Fructose gets split into two 3-carbon molecules, right? 3-phosphoglyceraldehyde, and as that gets converted to another compound, there it undergoes an oxidation-reduction reaction where two electrons are pulled off, and they're being carried by NADH around inside the cytoplasm. All right, here is the first step where an ATP is going to be produced. All right, and then here is the second step where a second is being produced. So we see that there are 4 ATP by both of these little side reactions. And then eventually you end up with 2 pyruvic acids. All right, now when you look at these reactions right here, do you see a one-way arrow or do you see a two-way arrow? You see a two-way arrow. So these intermediates can actually go backwards and forwards, right, depending on certain conditions inside the cell. So it is possible to make glucose from 2 pyruvic acids. And of course it is possible to make 2 pyruvic acids from a glucose. So which way is this reaction going to run? Is it going to run from top to bottom or from bottom to top? You know what? It's going to depend on the conditions inside the cell. Remember Le Chatelier's principle. What did Le Chatelier's principle say? If we have a chemical reaction, A plus B going to C plus D, all right, and it's a bidirectional reaction, if we get rid of A, which way is this reaction going to run? C and D are going to get used up to replenish the A that we took out of the system, right? So it can move to the right or to the left. Or if we put in a lot of B, which way is the reaction going to go? It's going to be pushed to the right, right? So in this particular case, right, instead of saying A plus B, let's just say glucose over here and pyruvic acid. I'll say pyruvate because it's shorter, right? If your body is using a pyruvate, what's that going to do? That's going to make glycolysis run in the forward direction, convert glucose into pyruvate. And what else is going to happen when it goes in that direction? It's going to produce ATP, okay? Or if ATP is low in the cell, if we take ATP away, which way is glycolysis going to run? Also to the right, to replenish that ATP. But if for whatever reason, ATP builds up inside the cell, what's going to happen? It's going to make glycolysis run backwards, and pyruvate is going to be converted into glucose. Okay, there are a couple other compounds that I want you to look at in glycolysis. It's not just ATP, but for glycolysis, what do we need? We need NAD+. All right, and then that's also going to produce what? NADH. All right, so when glycolysis is operating and NADH builds up inside the cell, what's that going to do to glycolysis? If this builds up, what happens to glycolysis? If NADH builds up, it's going to try to make glycolysis run in the reverse direction. All right, and when you stop glycolysis or make it go in the reverse direction, what happens to ATP production? It slows down or even stops. Now, what does that sound like to you? Well, that doesn't sound like a really good thing. I wouldn't volunteer for that, okay? Because I want my cells to make ATP. All right, so we have, so that's something interesting for us to consider, okay? We never want NADH to build up inside the cell because it can stop glycolysis from operating. And we want glycolysis because we don't get a lot of ATP out of it, but we get at least a fair amount of ATP. Okay. So that brings us to the lactic acid pathway. Okay, now remember, this all happens without oxygen. Let me go back to this slide right here. All right, so here's glycolysis. Okay, if oxygen is present inside the cell, the product of glycolysis, namely pyruvic acid, can enter the Krebs cycle. And also, the NADH that is produced in glycolysis can enter the mitochondria. So what does that allow glycolysis to do? If pyruvate enter the mitochondria and NADH enter the mitochondria, they get used up. So what happens to glycolysis? It keeps running in the forward direction, producing ATP, which is what you want. Okay? But whenever you cut off oxygen to a cell, all right, that pyruvate can't enter the mitochondria, it builds up. NADH can't enter mitochondria, it builds up inside the cell. And what happens to glycolysis? It runs in the backward direction, therefore stopping the production of ATP, and that's terrible for the cell. All right, so fortunately, there is a side reaction that can help. Even in the presence of no oxygen, and this is what's called the lactic acid pathway. All right, and here it is. Pyruvic acid is the final product of glycolysis, as well as what? NADH. So in order to prevent glycolysis from running in the reverse direction, there is an enzyme called lactate dehydrogenase, and it can combine NADH and pyruvic acid and make lactic acid out of it. Okay, what we see right here. What does that do? That removes pyruvic acid from the cytoplasm, all right, or from the cytosol. So pyruvic acid goes away. What does that do for glycolysis? Keeps it running in the forward direction. What else gets used up with the lactic acid pathway? NADH gets used up. And what does that do for glycolysis? It keeps glycolysis going in the forward direction, but there's something else too that's really handy. The lactic acid pathway produces what? NAD+, which is necessary for glycolysis to proceed. All right, so this lactic acid pathway, even in the absence of oxygen, will keep glycolysis working, producing some ATP for the cell to stay alive. So that's a pretty important reaction. Sometimes we call it a fermentation process because it happens without oxygen. And exactly what we call this is anaerobic respiration. Okay, anaerobic, why? No oxygen. And respiration, because what's it producing for us? This little side reaction right here is allowing glycolysis to keep operating, producing ATP, even in the absence of oxygen. All right, now do you see any CO2 being produced right here? There's no CO2 in that reaction. I think maybe next week or the week after, if you haven't done it already, you're going to do an alcohol fermentation reaction. Okay, and so instead, and you're going to use a different kind of animal, you're not going to be using a mouse, you're going to use something like a yeast cell. And yeast can make ATP via glycolysis, all right, but a yeast has the same kind of problem. If we feed yeast glucose inside the yeast cell, it's going to make ATP, which is good, but pyruvic acid is going to build up. NADH is going to build up inside a yeast cell, and that's going to stop glycolysis from operating. So what does a yeast do with pyruvate? How many carbons is pyruvate? It's three carbons. All right, and we got NADH. And what a yeast cell does is that then it's going to convert this back into NAD+, all right, plus a CO2, plus CH3CH2OH, which looks like this. Here's a carbon with hydrogens, and then there's a carbon here, and then an OH, and two more carbon molecules. Does anybody recognize this thing? Wow, you guys. What is that? Well, that's the active ingredient in adult beverages, which is what? Ethyl alcohol, okay? Ethyl alcohol, which we consume to become what? Intoxicated, all right? Because this is a toxic compound, all right? So yeast can get rid of pyruvic acid and NADH to keep glycolysis working by producing this toxic compound right here under anaerobic conditions. But why don't mammals have this reaction? Well, because if we did, we could get drunk just by holding our breath. Okay? So, because ethyl alcohol is toxic to our nervous systems, that wouldn't really be good. So, in mammals, what do we have? We have the lactate dehydrogenase pathway that doesn't produce ethyl alcohol. All right, and what else do you know about this fermentation process? It produces CO2, and what's that used for? CO2 is to use for making bread rise up. That's why you put yeast in bread to make it rise, and also for when you ferment champagne and beer and things like that, right? Because then that CO2 gets trapped in the bottle. All right, so this is an alcohol dehydrogenase reaction as opposed to the lactic acid dehydrogenase reaction. Right, so we don't need to have this kind of reaction in our body because we would get drunk just by holding our breath. All right, so you're gonna be working with that equation maybe next week in lab. All right, so what's the beauty? Let's just summarize. What's the beauty of the lactate dehydrogenase reaction? Yeah, it keeps glycolysis moving in the forward direction. And what does that produce for you? This ATP, which is all important for our biochemistry. Okay. Okay, so let me give you just another viewpoint. What is a coenzyme? What's it doing? It's a large organic molecule, right? But what's it doing for us? What does a coenzyme do for us? It carries something from one reaction to another, like maybe high energy electrons, for instance. All right, and you can maybe even think of ATP as being a coenzyme. All right, but what is ATP carrying around with it. And you might not want to think of a physical moiety, but you might want to think that it is actually it's something that's just as important as something physical, like a pencil or a pen or something. It's carrying what with it? Energy. Right? So you could think of ATP as a coenzyme, and what it's carrying from one reaction to another is energy so that endergonic reactions can proceed. All right, so that's a lactic acid pathway. All right, so anaerobic respiration only produces two ATPs for every glucose. And there are a couple cells in our body that don't contain mitochondria, namely red blood cells. Yeah. Glycolysis, the last product of glycolysis, okay, is going to be two pyruvates, two ATP, and we're saying the net reaction, right, and two NADHs. But that's not glycolysis. That is the lactate dehydrogenase pathway. That's an additional little step. Because pyruvate has two different fates inside the cell. Well, it has a couple different fates, but let's just say two different fates. One fate is with no oxygen. It's what? The lactate dehydrogenase pathway. But if there is oxygen present, pyruvate can enter the mitochondria, and then there's two more real important pathways we got to consider today. That's a Krebs cycle and electron transport. So I didn't talk about the other fates for pyruvic acid just yet. Yeah?
Regarding the lactic acid pathway,
yeah?
If mammals didn't have that, would the yeast allow the glucose to turn into alcohol?
Yeah?
That's what you were talking about. I was getting
close. Yeah. If we had alcohol dehydrogenase enzymes in our body instead of lactate dehydrogenase, whenever oxygen concentration goes down, pyruvic acid would build up, and then pyruvic acid would be converted into ethyl alcohol. And that's toxic for our nervous systems, right? And what would happen? Well, then we could be eaten by bears and whatever else would want to take advantage of us, right? So that's not a good thing. We get run over on the 405 freeway. So we don't have that enzyme in our bodies. But a yeast doesn't have a brain or central nervous system. So they get rid of pyruvate that way.
So that's why when making alcohol, when they close the cap, they prevent the...
Oh, that's right, because if the yeast has oxygen, then it's going to proceed with some of these other reactions that we haven't talked about yet. Okay? They have to be starved for oxygen in order to make alcohol. Yeah. Okay. All right. All right, so this lactic acid pathway occurs in skeletal muscle and heart muscle when oxygen falls below levels, because that oxygen, if it was at a high level, it would allow pyruvate to enter mitochondria. Or, for instance, during heavy exercise, or if there is a blockage of blood supply to an organ, then the lactic acid pathway is going to operate. And that lactic acid can actually leave the cell. We're going to see where it goes in just a little bit. Okay, here are some terms. You're going to have to know four important pathways relating to glucose metabolism. And these are tongue twisters, and they all kind of look the same. And you got to be really sure that you know how to spell these pathways and how to say them and what they really represent inside the cell. But they all have to do with glucose. All right, for osmotic reasons, right, cells can't store many free glucoses. Right, a cell likes to store glucose because it's energy. But if you put a million glucose molecules inside a cell, what's going to happen to the shape of that cell? Okay, it's going to change. That's right, because with all that glucose in there, it becomes what? More concentrated or less concentrated? Highly, highly concentrated. So water is going to do what? It's going to rush into the cell because all those glucose molecules are there. And what's going to happen to the cell? It's going to lyse. Right? It's going to blow up. So a cell needs to store glucose, but not in just millions and millions of particles because the cell's going to blow up. So what the cell does is that it takes glucose and jams them all together via what kind of reaction? A dehydration synthesis reaction, and it makes a compound called glycogen. So glycogen is a storage form of glucose, and it's just a single molecule, so it doesn't allow the cell to expand. And what's the basic building block of glycogen? It is glucose, right? It's just a big, huge polymer of glucose. All right. Here's the sign-in sheet. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? You don't need to pass it back there? Ah, that's good. Okay, so that process of making glycogen from glucose is what we call glycogenesis. What does genesis mean? To build something. And it builds it from glucose. Right? All right, skeletal muscle and liver store a lot of glycogen. Right? That's just a nice energy storage. Now, when your cells need glucose, guess where they can go? Where can that cell go to get glucose? It can get it from glycogen, right? It can snip off one building block from glycogen, and then what does a cell have? A little bit smaller piece of glycogen and a glucose molecule. What kind of reaction would a cell use to do that? That's a hydrolysis reaction, snipping off a glucose. That process is what we call glycogenolysis, right? Lysis is what? The splitting up of something. Where else did we see this lysis term? How about glycolysis? Glycolysis is what? The lysis of what molecule? Glucose, right? So glycolysis is the splitting of glucose, and glycogenolysis is the splitting of glycogen. All right, so these words are really similar, and if you don't have your reading prescription right up to date, okay, don't pretend like you know the difference between these terms. All right, so make sure that you know how to spell them and really know what they mean. Glycolysis versus glycogenolysis and glycogenesis. All right, so glycogenolysis clips glucose out of glycogen as a glucose-6-phosphate. And what does that phosphate group do? What's the benefit of having that phosphate group on this glucose molecule, for instance, if it's a muscle cell? That means it's trapped inside that muscle cell, and the muscle cell is not going to starve to death because that glucose has no place to go. It's going to stay in there and energize that muscle cell. Okay, so here we have a couple terms, and I guess I have to erase some things on the board. And what I want you to understand from this table, 5.1, are these four terms right here. So let me just put it in a nice format. Sorry about having to erase all this nice biochemistry. All right, what's the first thing? The first one is what we've just talked about. Glycolysis. All right, and what is glycolysis? Breaking down of glucose into 2-pyruvate. And, of course, you get some goodies out of it, like ATP. Right, so glycolysis is glucose going into pyruvate. Right, but, of course, you got to be a little bit more sophisticated. You should know, like, how many ATPs are produced, for instance. Okay. All right, so that's glycolysis. What's the next one? I'll take them in order. Glycogenesis. What's glycogenesis? It's the building of glycogen. All right, so how do you make glycogen? It's when you have glucose, all right, maybe plus another glucose that goes to glycogen. All right, and you should have a good feeling for why your body stores glucose or cells store glucose in the form of glycogen and not glucose. Right? That's so that the cells don't expand. Next one, glycogenolysis. What does glycogenolysis sound like? It sounds like glycolysis, but it's different because, don't forget that little O right there. All right? But this is what? Glycogen, not glucose. But it's the breakdown of glycogen, so what do you get? This goes from what? glycogen, and that produces what? Glucose. All right, that produces glucose for you. All right, and then there's one last pathway. And maybe I should have put this second, but it's number four in your table right here. And that is, hopefully, I'll look up in a second, gluconeogenesis. Is that what's in the table? Gluconeogenesis? Good. All right, so gluco stands for glucose. Neogenesis is what? The making of new glucose. How can you make new glucose? Okay, by taking two pyruvic acids and adding them together. That means what? Running glycolysis in the reverse direction. Okay, that's definitely possible to do that. All right, so you got two pyruvate going to glucose. All right, and so your body goes through all of these different reactions basically to maintain the proper level of glucose in your blood so that all the organs have that energy available in order to make ATP. All right, and these other terms we'll talk about a little bit, but I think you might have a little bit of a feel for this, like lipogenesis. What does that mean? Lipogenesis versus lipolysis. Genesis is the making of lipid, and lipolysis is what? The breaking down of lipids. Right. All right, ketogenesis is the making of ketone bodies. All right, so here is something that's pretty interesting that shows glycogenesis and glycogenolysis. Here we have a cell, and let's just say, this could either be a muscle cell or a liver cell, and maybe I'll ask you which one it is. Okay, we have glucose that's in the blood, and it can be taken up by a cell, right, if there is, those GLUT4 transporters in the membrane, because glucose just can't enter a cell all by itself, because it's a polar compound, so it needs a transporter to get in, like the GLUT4 transporter, for facilitated diffusion. So it gets inside the cell, and then there is a glucose kinase that phosphorylates it right away. So now this glucose 6-phosphate is trapped inside the cell. And the glucose has two possible fates. If this cell needs ATP, all right, guess what happens to this glucose? If it's low on energy, this glucose enters glycolysis and the cell makes ATP out of it. But if there's plenty of ATP in the cell, okay, what happens to this glucose? All right, it goes through a little bit of a rearrangement of that phosphate group, and then it is added to glycogen, so it is stored until the cell starts to run out of energy, starts to run out of ATP. All right, so when we go from glucose to pyruvate, what do we call that process? That's glycolysis. But if you have glucose and it ends up in glycogen, what do you call that process? That would be number one right here. That would be, yeah, glycogenesis, right? Glycogenesis. And then when that cell starts to run out of energy, what happens to this glycogen? It's hydrolyzed or broken down, right? Catabolized. And glycogen is converted into glucose. What is this pathway called? Number two. Glycogenolysis, right? That produces glucose, and now the cell can use it via glycolysis to make ATP. Okay, so that's what would happen in a muscle. There's one organ in your body that is kind of altruistic. It will give up glucose that it has for the benefit of the body, right? Not its own benefit, but the benefit of the body. And when blood glucose starts to decrease, that organ, right, will then hydrolyze glycogen via what pathway? Glycogenolysis, producing glucose, and then there is an enzyme that can dephosphorylate glucose 6-phosphate, turn it into regular old glucose, and then it can secrete it into the blood, bringing blood glucose levels back up, for instance, when you're in a fasted state. All right, and that would be the liver. So the liver can undergo glycogenolysis to boost blood glucose levels back up to where they should be. All right, but that only happens in the liver. All other tissues, way too greedy with glucose. Once it gets in there, those cells are going to use it themselves. All right. So the liver can only undergo glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis. This is number two right here. All right. And the reason why the liver can secrete glucose so no other tissue can is because it has this enzyme that can take phosphate off of glucose. Guess what we call that enzyme? That's a phosphatase, and we usually name enzymes by the substrate they work on, so that would be called glucose 6-phosphatase, right? Takes the phosphate off, and then that glucose can be secreted into the blood, maintaining your blood glucose levels, right? Glucose 6-phosphatase, right? And this would be glucose kinase over here because it's adding a phosphate on there. All right, so that shows you a little regulatory mechanism as well as naming some of these metabolic pathways, glycogenolysis, gluconeogenesis, all right, and all that kind of stuff. All right, now let's look at the Cori cycle. The Cori cycle is an interaction between skeletal muscle and the liver. Okay, when a skeletal muscle is contracting, exercising very strenuously, it's using up a lot of ATP. So that means glycolysis is going to be running in the forward direction. And when a muscle's contracted, like my biceps right here, okay, see this biceps right there? When it's contracted, it turns into what? This big solid mass. It just turns into a solid. Can blood get into this muscle when it's contracted? Because it's just a big solid mass, right? So what's happening to it, since blood can't get into it, what about oxygen? Is it getting into that muscle? No, it's starving for oxygen. All right, so what is operating? Glycolysis is operating because, why? The lactate dehydrogenase pathway is converting pyruvate to lactic acid. Lactic acid is building up inside that muscle. Okay, so during exercise, all right, pyruvate is being converted into lactic acid. That's the lactic acid dehydrogenase pathway, or you could call that what? Anaerobic respiration under anaerobic conditions. This muscle still needs energy, so it's still going to have glucose being converted into pyruvic acid. What's this metabolic pathway called? That is, glucose to pyruvate is glycolysis, right? And since glycolysis needs glucose, where does this cell get glucose from? Glycogen. So what is the pathway of glycogen being converted to glucose 6-phosphate called? Glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis, right? So glycogenolysis is operating when a muscle is exercising. Glycolysis is working as well as the anaerobic pathway is working. All of these pathways. Okay, now the fortunate thing is that lactic acid can leave the cell. Because if it build up in the cell, then it would actually inhibit glycolysis, right, because of the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. So lactic acid leaves, goes into the blood, and where does it go then? Everywhere in your body, including the liver. And the liver takes lactic acid up, right, and of course the liver is not a muscle that's contracting, so it still has blood going to it. And lactic acid gets back converted into pyruvic acid, which is the reverse of the LDH pathway, right? And then pyruvic acid is used to make glucose. 2-pyruvate is used to make glucose. What do we call this pathway where pyruvic acid is used to make glucose? That is gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis. And then, like we said, the liver is not necessarily greedy. It can release this glucose because it has the glucose 6-phosphatase enzyme. It goes back into the blood, and then this glucose can then go back and power these muscle cells that need glucose. All right, what's another possible fate of glucose 6-phosphate within the liver? Maybe the liver wants to store it. All right, so it will take glucose and make glycogen out of it. What do we call this metabolic pathway, the arrow going up? That is glycogenesis, right? Glycogenesis. And then once it's in there, the liver can break it down to put glucose back in the blood. This is a descending arrow. What would this pathway be called? Glycogenolysis, right? Glycogenolysis, producing glucose so that it goes back into the blood. All right, so this right here is probably a really important exam figure. All right, so make sure that you can label all of these in terms of the chemical reactions. Glycolysis, glycogenolysis, gluconeogenesis, right? That kind of stuff. They're tongue twisters, but make sure your glasses are good so you can see the difference in spelling between them, right? Yeah. Oh, it loves oxygen. It does best with oxygen. At least most muscles do. Some muscle types do best without oxygen. Ones that contract really, really fast for short bursts, for short periods of time, are what we call glycolytic, but the anaerobic kind need oxygen to perform. So for instance, that kind of explains why some athletes are really good at sprinting and other athletes are good for running marathons, because they have different kinds of fiber types that rely on different kinds of metabolism. Okay. So those that rely primarily on glycolysis without oxygen, some people think that those muscles aren't very sophisticated, but you know, for instance, if you look at an alligator, they don't have muscles that utilize oxygen very well. They utilize glycolysis. And would you ever want to arm wrestle an alligator? Never, right? So I can't say that one muscle type is, you know, better, more sophisticated than the other. They just have different purposes, okay? Yeah. Number five, lactic acid to pyruvate. That is just the reverse of the LDH pathway, lactate dehydrogenase. That's anaerobic respiration going in reverse. So maybe I would actually say, maybe a good way of thinking of this is, say, lactic acid going all the way up to glucose. I would say that is gluconeogenesis. Okay. That's anaerobic respiration. Pyruvate to lactic acid, that's anaerobic respiration, or you could say the LDH pathway, lactate dehydrogenase pathway. Okay. Now, what pathology, if you're going to really appreciate, what pathology do you really have to understand all these metabolic pathways? And is it prevalent? And have you ever heard of it? Okay. What can you tell me about glucose in the blood? Have you ever heard of a disease involving glucose in the blood? Diabetes. Oh, like diabetes mellitus. That's right. And so in order for you to really understand diabetes mellitus, you really have to know glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, glycogenolysis, right? Glycogenesis, because these are some pathways that are manipulated to help somebody with diabetes. All right, so this is really nice, fundamental kind of biochemistry. Yeah. Pyruvate to lactic acid, that is the anaerobic respiration, or you could call it the LDH pathway or lactate dehydrogenase pathway, right? Different ways of thinking about it, okay? All right, maybe these things are labeled in your textbook, right? Number one, number two, three, nine, for instance, okay? All right, so let's go back to this original slide right here. This is all really amazing, fascinating stuff. All right, so we've actually looked at just what's happening in the cytosol right now. We said pyruvate has a couple of different fates. When oxygen is absent, right, we use the LDH pathway to convert it into lactic acid to get rid of NADH and to prevent the buildup of pyruvate to keep glycolysis operating. But under normal circumstances, when oxygen is present, pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria, all right? But when can it enter the mitochondria? Only under aerobic conditions, all right? But when it does, we'll see that many, many more ATP are produced. So how many ATP are produced by glycolysis? Measly two, all right? That might be enough to keep some tissues alive, all right? But it's not going to be nearly enough to keep a brain or a heart or a kidney or a retina alive, because they need a lot more ATP. All right, so we have these mitochondria right here. There are three important pathways that I want you to know about the mitochondria. The first one is a preparation reaction. Okay, the second one is the Krebs cycle, and the third reaction is electron transport. But all of these reactions inside the mitochondria require oxygen. Maybe I should put it on this slide. You got to have oxygen that's being produced. I mean, that's going to be used by the mitochondria. All right, so where are we? Aerobic respiration. All right, so this is the preparatory reaction when pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria. So now we're inside the mitochondria. All right, aerobic respiration begins when pyruvate, formed by what? Glycolysis, enters the mitochondria. A CO2, this carboxyl group right here, is clipped off of pyruvic acid. All right, so, and it forms this CO2. All right, so here I could ask you, what organelle produces CO2 that you breathe out of your body? The mitochondria. Where does that CO2 come from? Comes from basically the glucose that's in your diet. All right, so CO2 is that gas, right? You breathe it out. It was a solid that you ate at that one time. All right, and here is coenzyme A. And coenzyme A is what, a cofactor or a coenzyme? Okay, it's a coenzyme. And it's what, A? Probably like the first one somebody ever discovered, right? Coenzyme A. And it's a big, huge organic molecule. You could Google it if you want to kind of take a peek and see what it looks like. But here is a functional group on it called a sulfhydryl group, right? That's a sulfhydryl group. It's very reactive. And this can participate in an oxidation reduction reaction. And NAD plus is needed, right? Another coenzyme that gets converted into NADH. And now we've got a CO2 and acetyl coenzyme A. An acetyl group is just a two-carbon fragment, right? So you got pyruvic acid. How many carbons in pyruvic acid?
Three.
There are three, and you chop one off, you're left with two, and that's an acetyl group or an acetyl group, right? But it is bound to acetyl coenzyme A. And this is a coenzyme, so what's the job of a coenzyme? It's going to ferry something around inside the cell from one reaction to another. And what does acetyl coenzyme A carry around inside the cell from one set of reactions to another? This acetyl group, this two-carbon fragment, right? It's carrying from one set of reactions to another. All right, so this is what we call the preparatory reaction. All right, you should appreciate it because it produces CO2, but it also produces NADH. And what is NADH carrying around with it?
Electrons,
but what kind of electrons? Really high energy electrons that mitochondria have figured out a way to make ATP from. All right, so NADH as well as acetyl coenzyme A. All right, so what happens to acetyl coenzyme A? Here you see that preparatory reaction. This just represents the outer mitochondrial membrane. Right, you got glucose, which is six carbons, getting broken down into two, three-carbon fragments. That enters the mitochondria, and it's decarboxylated, ending up with two-carbon fragments. Now, in order for pyruvic acid to enter the mitochondria, what has to be present here? What has to be present? Otherwise, it can't even get in. Oxygen. So this is the beginning of what? Aerobic respiration, because oxygen is necessary for these mitochondria to work. All right, so acetyl coenzyme A carries this two-carbon unit, or the acetyl group, to the Krebs cycle and donates it to the Krebs cycle. And I'm not going to ask you to memorize the intermediates of the Krebs cycle, but sometime you're going to have to do that, and you'll love it. All right, but maybe not for this class because I'm talking too slow. But here is a four-carbon molecule called oxaloacetic acid. It's going to grab this acetyl group, which is how many carbons? Two. And if you have the four carbon and two carbon together, you end up with another six-carbon unit right here. We call citric acid. And then it's rearranged and decarboxylated a couple times, producing two more CO2s. And then it can go around and around and around as long as we still have an input of acetyl coenzyme A. This is what we call the Krebs cycle. So the Krebs cycle produces two more CO2 molecules, but we're going to see that it also produces some other important energy molecules as well. Okay. All right, so what does a Krebs cycle produce? Let's just look at it, and then we'll take a look at a synopsis. So here is acetyl-CoA that it gets from the preparatory reaction. And there are some rearrangements, and there's, you know, some water goes in and goes out. And in this step right here, look what's produced. NAD plus gets converted to NADH. All right. Now, what's in this NADH right here? High energy electrons, which can be used later to make ATP. Right? This is the reduced form of NAD plus. And as it goes from isocitric acid to alpha-ketoglutarate, right, there's a decarboxylation step, right, so it produces CO2. And then if it goes to the next compound over here, right, it gets decarboxylated again. But what also happens? Another NADH is produced. And then also a GTP, guanosine triphosphate, is produced. And the free energy of GTP is basically equivalent to the free energy in ATP. So what can GTP be used to make? ATP. It's neither exergonic or endergonic reaction, so it just automatically happens inside the mitochondria. So the mitochondria C is really helpful because it's making an ATP for every one turn of the Krebs cycle. All right? So a question I have is, how many turns does the Krebs cycle go through for every glucose molecule? How many acetyl-CoAs are produced by one glucose? Two, because glycolysis does what? Splits glucose in half, so you get two acetyl-CoAs. So for every glucose, you get two turns of this cycle right here. All right, so for every glucose, you get two NADHs made. Another two NADHs made right here. And then two ATPs, and then furthermore, before the cycle is completed, look, another two NADHs are produced for what? Every glucose molecule. Yeah. It's just a base. It's a guanosine triphosphate, and ATP is an adenosine triphosphate. All right, but the high energy bond between the beta and gamma phosphate is basically the same. All right, it's just the shape of the base. Remember, what's a nucleotide look like? It's got the sugar molecule, okay, and then it's got a phosphate coming off, and then on the other side there is some kind of base right here, and an ATP, that base is adenine. All right, but for GTP, it's a little bit different shape. It's still a base. It's what? Guanine. Okay, it's guanine. But it's a really similar kind of molecule, and it's not deoxy, because that would make it a nucleotide for making DNA. It's just a nice ribose with what? An OH in this location right here. It's an energy function. And why ADP won out in evolution more than GTP, I'm not really sure. I should ask my boss. He's a physical chemist. You might actually know that. Actually, you should ask him. He might freak out. Go, oh, wow, what a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Okay. okay. But that's cool. I don't know. I might wake up in the morning and have an answer. Yeah. Right here?
Yeah.
Yes. Whenever you see an NAD, there should be a plus right by it. Okay, that's an oxidation reduction reaction. NAD plus is the oxidized form of NAD. NADH is the reduced form of NAD. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I wish, you know, your book is not really big on electrons. They seem to think protons are really important, but I think it's easier to see what's happening if you think about high energy electrons. Okay. Now, how can you remember? There's a couple of sayings, I forgot one saying, but there's a couple of sayings to help you remember oxidation reduction reactions, whether something becomes oxidized or reduced. One of the little sayings is Leo. Okay. Leo, what's Leo? Leo is a sign of what do we call that? Astrological sign? Am I close? Okay. Astrological sign. Leo, it's what? A lion. And what do lions do? grr, right? They roar. So you could say Leo grr, right? So what does that really mean in terms of this class? Lose electrons is oxidation. Gain electrons is reduction. All right, so that, you know, jot that down. If that could be a way out of a problem, if you don't see something happen, just jot that down, and maybe you can use that as a key to figure something out. Okay, so are we done? Should I go back to the other slide? Yeah, you're good. Okay. All right, so this is the Krebs cycle. Okay, so basically, what is a Krebs cycle doing? Where is it? It's inside the mitochondria. In order for it to work, what has to be present inside the mitochondria? Oxygen's got to be there. Right? All right, and then it gets some products from glycolysis, and when it turns like this, 1, 2, 3 NADHs are produced for every turn, and then for every glucose, don't forget there's two turns. One ATP, and you know what, I forgot another coenzyme. There's an FAD that gets converted into FADH2. All right, so the basic synopsis for Krebs cycle, okay, is what? Three NADHs, one FAD, and one ATP molecule. Okay, so in your notes somewhere, I do want to say one little thing about this production of ATP right here. For sure, it can only be produced when oxygen is present, but it's a kind of ATP production that we call substrate level. It's just catalyzed by enzymatic reactions. All right, so say that the ATP produced by the Krebs cycle is substrate level phosphorylation. And that kind of phosphorylation of ADP is very, very similar to the production of ATP by glycolysis. So as a matter of fact, in your notes someplace, say that the two ATP that are produced by glycolysis are through substrate level phosphorylation. Okay, substrate level, glycolysis and Krebs cycle. All right, this leads us to the last pathway. And this last pathway is what we call the electron transport chain. And I'm probably going to just call it ETC for short to save my voice a little bit. And ETC is in the mitochondria. All right, so, and again, this can only happen when what is present? Oxygen. And you're going to see why in just a second. All right, so NADH, what is NADH carrying around with it? High energy electrons. NAD can bump into some proteins and other kinds of compounds that we saw call cytochromes in the inner mitochondrial membrane. All right, remember your kind of picture of a mitochondria? It's got an outer membrane, and what else does it have? It's got an inner membrane that kind of looks like this, right? And all these folds of the inner membrane we call Christi. All right, and so the electron transport chain are just a bunch of molecules in the inner mitochondrial membrane. But remember, membranes you should think of as what? A fluid mosaic model. All kinds of things can be added to membranes to change the function of them. And this inner membrane is changed because it can carry electrons around. So these molecules almost sort of act like a wire carrying electrons, like we use in buildings right here. All right, so NADH, which is a reduced form, becomes oxidized. That remakes NAD+. But those electrons have to go someplace else, right? And we're not going to have to know the names of these different compounds, but there's something called FMN, which is oxidized and it becomes reduced, right, into FMNH2. So if NADH becomes oxidized, something else has to become reduced because oxidation-reduction reactions always take place together. And so there is a flow of these electrons from one compound to another to another. So the next one would be coenzyme Q, and then cytochrome B, and then cytochrome C1. And as these electrons move from one molecule to another, right, they lose free energy. So this is what kind of reaction when these electrons go from NADH, right, down to, say, cytochrome A3 right here. What kind of reaction is that? Endergonic or exergonic? All right, so NADH is high free energy. Cytochrome A3 is low free energy. That means it's releasing energy. And what's the cool thing about mitochondria? They have learned how to capture that energy to take ADP and inorganic phosphate and make ATP out of it, all right, which is what? An endergonic reaction, all right? So ETC, which is highly exergonic, is used to make how many ATPs, starting with NADH? 1, 2, 3 ATPs. Right, so for every NADH, mitochondria can make 1, 2, 3 ATPs. That's why we say NADH is carrying high energy electrons, because ETC can make a gob of ATP out of it, right? 50% more than glycolysis, and that's just for one NADH. And how many NADHs now do we have to play with? Well, we've got some from glycolysis, we've got three from the Krebs cycle, plus what else do we have from the Krebs cycle? We have one FADH2. These are carrying high energy electrons, but not just quite as high an energy as NADH. So for every FADH2, ETC can only make two ATPs, not three. All right, so these electrons are not at quite the same free energy, as you can see on this diagram, as these NADHs. All right, so these electrons flow as a result of oxidation-reduction reactions through that membrane, but they have to end up someplace, because if these electrons build up anywhere along this electron transport chain, what's going to happen to ETC? What happens if the concentration of electrons builds up someplace? It's going to slow down electron transport, maybe even try to force it in the reverse direction. So these electrons have to disappear. And how do they disappear? Okay, they disappear because we're breathing in oxygen all the time. And one of the things that oxygen loves to do is to become reduced. It loves to accept electrons. And when it does, especially if there's some protons around, if we take these two electrons and some hydrogens and oxygen, we can make water out of it. All right, so if these electrons have no place to go, then electron transport stops. What happens to ATP production? It stops. Krebs cycle stops. All right, and those cells can't make all of that ATP, and most tissues die as a result of that. So that's why mitochondria need oxygen, because they're the final electron acceptor that keeps ETC working. All right, the other thing that you notice on this diagram is, what is the final product of aerobic respiration? Is water. Yeah, I'm glad you saw that. It's kind of freaky, because when you think of water, what do you think of? Well, it's just something that acts as a solution inside your body. But what is it really doing? It's a very important metabolite that participates in almost all chemical reactions in your body. Due to what? Dehydration synthesis reactions, hydrolysis reactions, and even, this is what we call oxidative phosphorylation. Even water is an important metabolite of oxidative phosphorylation that produces all of this ATP for our bodies. Okay, so we look today at two kinds of respiration, anaerobic respiration and aerobic respiration. And we looked at some intricacies, but I want you to be sure you know what the bottom line importance of cellular respiration is, whether it's anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration. Why is there such a thing as aerobic or anaerobic respiration in our bodies? What's the purpose of it? It's basically really nice and simple as that. It's just to make ATP, right? So don't lose track of the big picture. Respiration makes ATP. And how many ATPs does anaerobic respiration make? Easily two. And I think next week we're going to talk about how many ATPs are made by aerobic respiration, by counting up all the NADHs and FADHs that are made, all right? And then here's the last thing that I want you to ponder over the weekend, okay? Through ETC, it operates because oxygen is present. This kind of phosphorylation of ADP is called what? oxidative phosphorylation. That's one important kind of phosphorylation. What's the other kind of phosphorylation that we see at, that we see right here? This is substrate level phosphorylation. So in your mind, I want you to categorize phosphorylation of ATP as being one of two kinds. Substrate level that we see in the Krebs cycle and in glycolysis versus what? Oxidative phosphorylation that takes place where? In the electron transport chain, which is has to do with this inner mitochondrial membrane. So when we come back on Tuesday, we're going to talk about the chemiosmotic theory and how mitochondria have figured out a way to actually make all of that ATP from those high-energy electrons. So if you want to read ahead a little bit, that would be really good to look at. All right, so I got the sign-in sheet down here if you guys need the sign-in sheet. And if you want to look at your tests, then, you know, I have some office hours coming up. But if you're in lab right now, I'm going to bring your tests up to lab. And when you're done with lab, you can look at your tests after lab. Okay?